From CAFE, welcome to CAFE Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
How are you, Ann?
I'm good.
It's October 1st.
Yeah, it's
paid
fall.
You paid your rent?
I hope so, yeah.
Or your mortgage or
automatically,
whatever.
I think. I try.
Oh, I've always gotten the sense that you're financially responsible.
Yeah. More than not.
And you don't want to tell the whole world whether you are or
preponderance
not.
Preponderance of the evidence, more often than
so
not.
So we're taping on the morning of October 1st, Tuesday. We did not tape yesterday because of the Jewish New Year. Happy Rosh Hashanah, everyone.
Happy Rosh Hashanah.
But it's a good thing we didn't tape yesterday morning because at about 4 p.m. yesterday, there was an avalanche of news.
Yes.
Story after story after story. So we are now able to talk about those things. Let's start with something that you tweeted about a few days ago, which I thought was both right on the money and also funny, which was after Rudy Giuliani appeared on Fox, I think, saying, you know, in ways to defend his behavior, he held up his mobile phone. Is it a Galaxy? Is it an iPhone? I can't remember what it was. So he holds up his phone and starts reading from text and says, all my information, all my investigation, it's all right here on this phone. And you said, why hasn't anyone subpoenaed Giuliani's phone yet and him?
Yeah.
And guess what?
They did.
They did. I think they were following your Twitter feed.
I don't tweet a lot. So
you should tweet more.
Every once in a while, throw it out because I can't take it. So I was watching the Fox News clip. I was sort of thinking a lot about Giuliani, and
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. It's
wow.
True.
Wow.
But he's one of the more fascinating parts of this event. I was going to say story, but, you know.
Saga
is the right word. And so I'm watching him on Fox News hold up his phone and say, it's all here. It's all in here. And I was like, oh.
Let's go get it.
Right. Because you and I still think like prosecutors. And the first thought I had was, great, somebody needs to take it. And so they have issued a very comprehensive subpoena to Giuliani that's returnable on October 15th that basically says, give us every document, every communication you have related to Ukraine, to Hunter Biden, to Burisma, to contacts with the State Department. And this is really important because I think there are a lot of unanswered questions. Like, forget the phone call for a second even, which is critically important, but all these questions about who Giuliani was interfacing with at the State Department, what they said, whether or not it's been reported and it's corroborated, I think, in a number of ways through the whistleblower complaint and otherwise, that both that the Ukrainians knew that military aid wasn't being given and that one of the deals that had to be made before the president of the United States, President Trump, would talk to President Zelensky was an agreement that they would talk about Biden. Who cut that deal?
Right.
Right? Was Giuliani in it? Was someone from the State Department in it? And so I think that there is so much that needs to be answered about Giuliani. Now, what's not in the subpoena, from what I can tell so far, you know, maybe I read it pretty quickly. It's, you know, 4 or 5 pages. But you raised a really interesting question last week that I've been thinking a lot about, which is who's paying Rudy Giuliani?
Right. Well, that's going to get to the question, perhaps, of what ability he has not to respond to the subpoena. So the subpoena, as you said, it's a lot of details, a lot of names. It's really comprehensive. Probably took them a few days to put together a fully comprehensive subpoena attachment. But I also want to make reference to the cover letter, which is significant for a couple of reasons. The tone is sharp and strong. But first, the letter says, your failure or refusal to comply with the subpoena, including at the direction or behest of the president or the White House, this is important, shall constitute evidence of obstruction of the House's impeachment inquiry and may be used as an adverse inference against you and the president. So that's point one, which I think is incredibly important. Whether or not they're able to ultimately compel the documents and the testimony, they're going to say, for lay people, if you don't give it up, we're going to assume it's the worst. We're going to assume it's against you. And that could constitute an article.
And this is so important because what we've seen repeatedly is the administration just say, uh-uh, we're not giving it to you. And what Congress is finally doing is really stepping up and saying, okay, if you don't give it to us, it falls against you. You're obstructing our investigation. And we're telling you that up front. So you're going to make a choice and you can say no, but that then we're going to count that against you, which is really important. We'll talk about Pompeo in a minute. That's also in the Pompeo letter.
And the other part of the letter that's interesting, that doesn't have legal significance yet, but tells you what the committees are thinking and they're putting it out there. It says, to me, this was the most significant sentence in the cover letter. And it says, our inquiry includes an investigation of credible allegations that you, meaning Rudy Giuliani, you acted as an agent of the president in a scheme to advance his personal political interests by abusing the power of the office of the president. So people keep asking, is Giuliani in jeopardy as well? What is the theory of the case against Giuliani? We don't know yet, but you know, this is a little bit of a grenade rolled across the threshold of Rudy Giuliani's office.
It also, frankly, reads like Article 1 of the Articles of Impeachment. a little bit, that this is the allegation against the president, that he abused his office in concert with Rudy Giuliani and others. And so I read that as, you know, this is the theme that Congress is going to explore, and this is, you know, what it's all going to come down to.
Yeah. So separately from all that, I don't think it's of legal significance necessarily yet, but they do make reference to Rudy's appearances on television. And it makes specific reference to his appearance on CNN when he was on with Chris Cuomo. When Cuomo said, so you did ask Ukraine to look into Biden, and remember,
he said no at first, right?
Yeah, but he said, of course I did.
Yeah.
So you did ask Ukraine to look into Joe Biden?
Of course I did.
You just said you didn't.
No, I didn't ask him to look into Joe Biden. I asked him to look into the allegations that related to my client, which tangentially involved Joe Biden in a massive bribery scheme.
Rudy.
Not unlike
Rudy.
What he did in China.
Rudy.
Damn right I ordered the code red. So it's another example, like the president, of things that he's saying that can be used against him in court documents. So here's where the lay of the land is. Let's discuss next. What right or privilege Rudy Giuliani has not to testify. Now, the one thing he said that people play over and over again when he was on one of the Sunday shows, when asked, are you going to cooperate with Adam Schiff before the subpoena was issued? He said, no, I think Adam Schiff is an illegitimate chair of the committee, so he doesn't like him very much, and says he should resign, and then says, I will not cooperate as long as it's Adam Schiff. And then, as he often does, when said, okay, so I guess you're not going to cooperate. He's like, oh, I didn't say that.
Right.
I will consider it, and it depends on what the president wants me to do.
I don't know why, but when you were just saying it, it felt like, I will not eat green eggs and ham.
Rudy, I am.
I don't know why that went through my head. So, yeah, so he basically, you know, he's got all kinds of excuses. Adam Schiff is not legitimate. Then wasn't there something about it's only issued by the Democrats on the committee, not by the full committee?
It has to be signed by the Democrats, which is not how the Benghazi subpoenas worked. It's not how it works.
Right. And so there's just a lot of sort of nonsense. And it's a little bit of the throw everything up against the wall and see what sticks. What's really fascinating about the Giuliani piece and the TV piece in particular is that it really is a part and parcel of this whole conversation, because he's been making a lot of statements on TV, including, you know, he said in publications, I'm not acting as the president's
yes.
lawyer. I'm acting, you know, on behalf of the government to, like, improve the republic. He's said all kinds of things that really any defense he would have to try to, I personally don't think, and we should break this down, I don't think arguments of attorney-client privilege will work for a variety of reasons. There's really, to me, no barrier to Giuliani being compelled to provide this information and to talk. But he's going to come up with a series of different things that we should be expecting.
So let's focus on attorney-client privilege for a few minutes. One, as you point out, in various contexts, he has said he wasn't acting as the president's lawyer. And then you look at the things he's done and the things about which the subpoena asks. And I don't understand what lawyer-client interest was being vindicated. At a surface level, it looks like he was operating as like a fixer for the president or a campaign operative for the president, trying to help him in the campaign. There's no legal case pending against Donald Trump with respect to what Rudy is doing that he's trying to defend the president from. So as an initial matter, just because someone happens to have a law license and has a conversation with somebody who is putatively the client, that doesn't shield everything that's discussed from attorney-client privilege. If you decide to mow a guy's lawn, have conversations about the mowing of the lawn, and you were also his lawyer, you can, you know, depose the guy on the mowing of the lawn conversations in the contract there. This seems to be like that. Separate from his saying that he wasn't acting as the lawyer, there's also, by the way, as people keep pointing out, there's a crime fraud exception. Even if he's acting as a lawyer, if there's some theory by which you can argue that there was a criminal conspiracy going on, I don't know if that's true, and that I think we're, you know, way shy of that. But you can pierce the privilege. And then there's also the argument, and I don't know how far this goes. I'm not an expert on this in the Congress, that congressional committees don't recognize the attorney-client privilege.
Right. They don't. They don't, because it's not constitutional. The attorney-client privilege comes from common law, meaning it's handed down by courts through cases. And so Congress has always said that they don't honor the attorney-client privilege, in part because it's not a trial over your liberty, right? It's just a totally different question, and it's an investigation by Congress. It's not a criminal trial. And so a lot of the reasons that attorney-client privilege exists don't exist here. Now, I don't think that means that Congress gives no deference to the attorney-client privilege, because I think they're going to try to be reasonable. But in addition to the fact that Congress doesn't have to honor it, the points you made are really well taken. Rudy is actually not acting like Donald Trump's lawyer, and, you know, attorneys can't help clients commit fraud. But there's something else in addition to all this, which is that all of these public statements, you don't get to selectively apply the attorney-client privilege. You can't basically say, and by the way, we also saw this during the acting DNI's testimony a little bit, the Joseph McGuire on executive privilege, where he was trying to pick and choose what parts of it he was going to say are privilege. You don't get to do that.
You're saying there's a waiver.
Yeah, there's a waiver. And so Rudy going up and talking about half of this stuff and being willing to answer questions on it, you then can't keep the rest of it secret. And so I personally, I see no legal basis for Rudy to win on the attorney-client privilege question.
So look, there may be some other privileges. There's a privilege sometimes acknowledged, executive privilege, deliberative process privilege. Again, Rudy Giuliani is not a member of the United States government. He's sort of a free agent, private citizen. So all those other privileges that you can argue about with respect to getting counsel from someone in the White House or at the Department of Justice or something else don't apply to him either.
Right.
And again, just separate from everything else, I still don't know what Rudy Giuliani's job is.
Yeah, that's a really important point, because if Rudy Giuliani is a part of the government and working at the State Department, none of that is privileged,
right?
And so he sort of wants it both ways, to both be a private lawyer and to be part of the government. I mean, he said, I was instructed by the State Department. I got, you know, I was working closely with the State Department. That would never be privileged. And so you raise a really good point. I also am really concerned about his conflicts of interest. And one of the things, generally, when you work for the government, you have one client, and it's really problematic to have multiple clients because you're supposed to only put the interests of the United States government forward. And so we know that Giuliani has represented other foreign governments. We know that he has been engaged on with a host of different people he's represented. And so I think there are also real questions of who does he represent, who's paying him, who's taking money, and just what is his role in this? One last point on the Giuliani subpoena. One thing that's interesting about it is that there are a few people that he works with. These people, Igor Fruhnman, Lev Parnas, Vitaly Pruss, Sam Kislin, Joseph DeGeneva, Victoria Tensing, and there are a number of people who are listed in the subpoena. And so it's not just Giuliani. And it's really important to recognize this, that as in all things, when you do a criminal investigation, it's really just two people who are involved. And so the House has done a good job of saying we want to talk to everyone involved in the investigation, including everyone involved with Giuliani, everyone involved with the Ukrainian folks, and everyone involved with the State Department. And that matters because that's where the dam breaks. That's where people start to talk, people start to cooperate. And so I would argue that Giuliani is critically important for him to provide that information, but it's less important than people may initially think because there are a lot of people listed.
Now, what do you make of this issue that's not legal? It's not about privilege, but about sort of appearance and strategy, because I keep hearing reports that are understandable that there's some people on the Democratic side who think it'll be, what's the word? I hate to use this word because it's family programming. If you have Giuliani come testify, it will be a shit show.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to argue with him. And he throws out a lot of, you know, misleading statements, and he's all over the place and he will talk over you. We see how he does it on the talk shows. There are some people who think that it won't be great and you won't advance the cause if he does agree to testify and sits in front of a committee, particularly given the nature of legislators questioning 5 minutes at a time.
Right.
If they don't have someone like Barry Burke,
yes,
you know, a practiced lawyer who knows how to ask questions, you know, at the end of the day, are they bluffing perhaps and they actually don't want Rudy to testify, but they just want the documents?
That's a great question. I think they're starting in the right place with the documents and not with Rudy himself, because the text messages, there'll be two people on them. And so you might want to get the other person in to say, hey, what else did you talk to Giuliani about? You'll be able to get a lot of evidence without actually having Rudy come in. To your point, I would assume, and I think you would assume, that he will come in and not be truthful, that he will do what he does on TV, which is spin excuse after excuse, story after story. And so if you have that, if you know that's going to happen, you need to have the evidence to be able to refute those stories. And so if he does testify, I would suggest that it's at the end, not at the beginning, and that the questioning be done by someone who actually knows how, like the Barry Burke is a great example, and there are other people like him, people who know how to present questions, because otherwise you're giving, it's like giving another opportunity for somebody to go on cable news and just, you know, spout and say whatever he wants. The reality is, if you're at the end of the investigation, you should be able to say to Giuliani, did you have this conversation? And just pin him down on the facts that you know, pin him down on what happened. And you and I talk about this a lot, but it's important to recognize one of the things that members of Congress do terribly when they do these interviews and these questions is that they want people to agree with their conclusions. people, fact witnesses, particularly people who are adverse to you or who don't like what you're doing, are going to agree with facts, not with conclusions. Yeah. And so, you know, this is one of those examples where it has to be tightly controlled, the questioning, and it has to be fact, fact, fact. And then you draw the conclusion, and Giuliani can say yes or no at the end if you feel the need to do it. But really, it's too much trying to sort of get Giuliani to agree with someone else's worldview. And as you said, who knows what worldview he's going to come in with that day, but it's not going to be the one that is consistent necessarily with the evidence.
I just want to digress for a moment because you just reminded me of something. You know, I don't mean to call anyone out, but it's really terrible. And the example that came to mind when I was hearing you speak was Secretary of State Pompeo. On the question, he was asked the question, not a bad question, about the call between President Trump and Zelensky. And he's asked, do you know anything about this?
Of the president's July 25th call with the president of Ukraine, what we've learned in the last 24 hours is that Pompeo was actually on that call.
What do you know about those conversations?
So you just gave me a report about a high-seek whistleblower campaign, none of which I've seen.
So he changes the question to be about the complaint by the whistleblower, not about the phone call, to which then, okay, so, well, you don't know anything about it. That is not what he said.
Yeah.
It's not what he said. And I get that people are complaining about Pompeo and that he was being too cute. Some people are suggesting he lied. He did not lie. He was not asked a sharp, pointed question with a rigorous follow-up. The follow-up should have been, wait a minute. I mean, we've talked about this a lot. I mean, the level of frustration that we have at how members of Congress ask questions. In case members of, I don't mean to sound very arrogant on our part, but it's our podcast, we can be. When you don't get an answer to the question, if it's a simple question, ask the same damn question again. Do you know anything about that phone call? He didn't answer it. The next question should have been, do you know anything about that phone call? And or you could say, were you listening to the phone call? Did you get a readout of the phone call?
Right.
Did you talk to anybody about the phone call? What do you know about the phone call? Were you concerned about the phone call? Instead, they moved right on. The same thing has happened in questioning between members of Congress and Bill Barr. And later, it's fun, I guess, weeks and months later, we'll see on cable television a rerun of a particular question. And in almost every case, you find there's not a lie. There's weasel words. There's evasiveness.
Evasive is the right word.
But and again, obviously, the person who's being evasive and being too cute for comfort is the person who's blameworthy. But if you're really going to be trying to perform your oversight function well, then you got to get better at this.
Yes, I could not agree more. I think Pompeo was evasive. I think he intentionally misled, and or at least he intentionally gave the impression that he was not aware. That's what everyone took away from that conversation. And that, to me, is deeply problematic. He's an official of the United States government. But you are 100% right that there was a hugely missed opportunity. And we've seen this repeatedly where the questions have to be asked and they have to be answered and they have to be asked again until the truth comes out.
Chris Wallace on The Sunday Show, Chris Wallace and Jake Tapper, our colleague, I think both did an excellent job with very different and difficult guests on the show. Chris Wallace is asking Stephen Miller repeatedly the same question. And it was, given that the president has the State Department and the CIA and all these other government agencies and government personnel, why is he using a personal lawyer to do these things? And Stephen Miller tried to talk about something else. He said, no, I've asked you a specific, don't talk to me about John Durham.
Is it not in the interest of all Americans to know what that is?
We're going to get to what the Bidens in a minute, but I've asked you a specific question. I'd like a specific answer. The president has the State Department. He's got the CIA. He's got the Pentagon. He's got a number of other agencies. Why did he use three private lawyers to get information on Biden from the Ukrainian government rather than go through all of the agencies of his government?
Two different points. Number one.
How about answering my question?
John Durham, as you know.
Wait a minute. John Durham is investigating something completely different. Stephen, I'm asking you a direct question. Why did the president—
And he would not answer the question. And then Chris Wallace, you know, he put an exclamation mark on it and says, no, we don't have an answer. We have your non-answer. And Jake Tapper did the same thing with Jim Jordan.
And then when the company that's paying him that money mm-hmm. is under investigation, guess what? Daddy comes running to the rescue. The vice president of the United States
that's
comes running
That's not
and
what
says,
happened,
fire,
sir.
Fire that prosecutor.
Sir, that's not what happened. The European Union, the Obama administration, the International Monetary Fund.
So the Biden campaign decides to send a letter to the major networks asking them not to book Rudy anymore. They say, quote, we are writing today with grave concern that you continue to book Rudy Giuliani on your air to spread false, debunked conspiracy theories on behalf of Donald Trump, blah, blah, blah. Don't give him airtime. So I'm going to say that was an error.
I would agree with that very much. And you and I have talked about this a lot this in different contexts, but this felt to me like a couple things. First of all, you're not going to convince cable. You're not going to tell cable news what's newsworthy and what isn't. Number one.
Increased his bookings.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Number two, you're drawing attention. You're sort of like, you're complaining about something that makes it look publicly as though you're trying to create a fair fight in a way. But the reality of this is that this is a presidential election. Joe Biden is entered into the arena. It's a blood sport, as we know from American politics. It always has been. And this is, I think, extreme. But it looked like complaining and whining about something that, is he right? There's something that Biden is right on. And I would have his press people call the networks. If I were him, I would have my press people call the networks all the time if they don't immediately fact check and refute and say to Giuliani, what's your proof of that? What's your proof of that? Nobody should let him go on to lie. And in fact, the networks themselves, if they know he's lying, should do what Chris Wallace did or what, you know, sort of effective questioning. But to say, don't give him airtime as part of this conversation, it feels to me wrong. And politically, it looks like censorship. What did you think?
Yeah, I thought it was unwise politically, optically. And you do what I think good folks and smart folks do in these circumstances is behind the scenes, when you see a bad performance and you see an anchor not fact check or accept lies, if you think they are, you call them up and you call up them and you call up their boss and you say, well, this is nonsense. And why didn't you do this way or that way? So the next time you do a better job, or you arm them in advance and you say, listen,
right,
you're going to have Rudy on again tonight. Here's the three false things he said yesterday. You should know this is why these are false, and we're not going to be happy. Again, they don't have any authority over anchors, but you know what? I still do believe that the best journalists on television and in print want to do a good job, don't want to be taken advantage of, don't want to be used and manipulated and exploited as mouthpieces for someone who's telling lies. So they will take that information in. And I'm sure they're doing that anyway, but you do just that. And then you counter by having your own people on. But, you know, a blanket request for him not to be booked. It also allows the worst thing that I think resulted from this. It allows Giuliani to play the victim card and say, I'm being censored. They're afraid of me. They don't want the truth to come out. So, I don't know. It was sort of bad all around.
One thing I'd say about the media is I do think there's something that's happening in this cycle that feels different to me than other cycles, which of sort of events and news, which is that there is a quicker move to rebut falsehoods, and there's a quicker move by the media to call out the administration on falsehoods. And one good example is there was something in, I think, the Federalist that came out arguing that the Inspector General had just changed their rules recently as to whistleblowers, and that it used to not allow hearsay, which is a statement that you haven't, you know, an out-of-court statement that is offered in court usually to prove the truth of what was said. It's complicated in the law. It's not worth spending a ton of time on other than to say that's the rules were never changed. The rules have always been to allow whistleblowers to come in and offer either firsthand or secondhand information. And what was great is that the Inspector General of the intelligence community immediately came out, and others immediately came out to say, that's a lie. The rules have not been touched since May of 2018. Stop saying that. And that was powerful, because otherwise these things, sometimes the falsehoods get legs and the media repeats them because nobody's rebutted them. It shouldn't happen. The media should do a better job than that. But that's the reality of the world we live in. And so we're seeing people immediately saying, no, that's not true. And I think it's really important because it changes the conversation to be more focused on what truly happened versus almost propaganda right? Like there's a...
I would say not almost.
Yeah. Right. But don't you... I feel like reading and listening to cable news and both watching TV and reading things, this is the closest I can ever think of an administration in my lifetime. And by the way, I'm sure people can tweet at me a million other examples.
No, probably not.
But it really feels like propaganda, and people are pushing the certain narratives. There's no quid pro quo. You can't have hearsay. I mean, we could go through all of them and rebut them one by one. But it really does feel like a concerted effort to change the conversation and to really distract from the underlying question of the president abused his authority to push a foreign country to investigate his political rival.
So I have two reactions to that. One is, which I hadn't thought of until you were talking about it. You look at the contrast between, they have different positions, but the contrast between two government officials, one the special counsel, Robert Mueller, and the other, the ICIG, the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, both of whom, you know, are trying to do their job. They're sort of quiet folks. They're not going on TV, but they see misstatements made and erroneous conclusions being bandied about on television about their work, Mueller, by and large, kept his mouth shut. No comment, no comment. The IG puts out a multiple-page rebuttal of this thing about hearsay with respect to whistleblower complaints. It's a little bit different. And, you know, I think when done within bounds and when not done in a showy way and it's done in a thorough, respectable manner, I think it's helpful to the public debate. What do you think?
I agree completely. And it was because otherwise the administration, again, is framing the debate in the wrong way and making it about things that it's not about. And so, look, they have every right to argue in their defense, but they were arguing something that's an actual falsehood about the way that the Intelligence Committee Inspector General operates. And so for him to come out, Michael Atkinson, the Inspector General, to come out and immediately say that's false is hugely important. And I agree completely that, it wasn't showy. It wasn't done in any type of political way. It was just that's not accurate. Here's the way it works and has worked. And then the facts are out there, which helps enormously for people in the media and members of the public to know, oh, that's false.
My second reaction to what you were saying was I think the larger question on the whistleblower is not this nonsense about the form, the complainant form, but all the deflection and misdirection and ridiculousness about hearsay. Put aside this as a whistleblower for a moment. In the United States of America, every day in police departments and in U.S. attorneys' offices and in cases being done by the FBI and the DEA, every agency on earth, including in companies, people give tips. You know, people call 911 and they say, there's a strange smell coming from the trunk of my neighbor's car. Depending on the circumstance, that person could be a felon. That person might not be credible. Ultimately, that person is not going to be your key witness at trial when you're trying to hold the neighbor accountable because it turns out there was a cadaver in the trunk. But law enforcement officials, if they didn't take seriously based on other indicia of credibility, which were found here on the part of folks who may not have direct knowledge. You know, somebody is working at a bank and they hear, you know, three other people at the bank say, well, I think the CEO of the bank is cooking the books. I think that's happening. And there are various reasons to believe that that's true. Yeah, that person can be a whistleblower. And if he goes to the general counsel, the board of directors of the bank, they'd be idiots and stupid and remiss and negligent if they didn't look into that. So this whole business of attacking the whistleblower is a political attempt to defend something that they're finding very, very hard otherwise to defend, but it doesn't really matter. And by the way, the other point to make on the ICIG's rebuttal was not only, just to be absolutely clear about this, was not only that the statute doesn't require direct knowledge. He said this whistleblower did have direct knowledge. He checked both boxes. He checked the box saying, with respect to some things, I have direct firsthand knowledge. With respect to other things, I have secondhand knowledge.
Yes, I agree with that. And one of the reasons I think that the whistleblower is so credible is that he was also forthright about that in saying up front, page one of the complaint, there's some things I know myself and some things I have secondhand knowledge of. Now, just high level on the whistleblower statute and why this is working exactly the way it's supposed to work is that it is very common for whistleblowers not to have firsthand knowledge, not to have access to the books you just described, not to have access to the president's phone call. The nature of whistleblowing is that the whistleblower is giving information about a problem that they may not be fully read into, right? Because the people that have access to the president's call, for example, the whistleblower may not have access to it. The whole point is to be able to say, I think there's something wrong here. You should go investigate. And then it's up to the inspector general to go get the phone call, to interview the witnesses, to figure out whether or not it's credible. Just like in your example, it's up to the police to go out, look what's happening. Why is there a smell in the car? That's such, the cadaver smells freaking me out.
That totally happens.
But it does totally happen. And it's really important that the whistleblower, to say that a whistleblower would need to have firsthand knowledge of all wrongdoing, would set it up so that it would never work right as a structural matter. And it's not intended to work the way that the president has suggested.
Let me just say, like to sketch out the argument in greatest fairness to the people who are supporting the president on this point is this. It is true that based on secondhand information or hearsay information, as the case may be, that we don't send someone to prison unless there's an exception. By the way, there are also exceptions to this because you have the call itself, which is not hearsay. You have other admissions on the part of the person who's the target. It's not hearsay, but I don't want to get bogged down. But generally speaking, you want to have direct evidence. before you convict someone and before you take serious action. That's all fair. We're not at that stage yet. You know, they have decided to open an impeachment inquiry. There's three things. First, the impeachment inquiry. They made the decision to do that, which is now endorsed by Nancy Pelosi. If and when they have sufficient evidence, which is what they're gathering in connection with a subpoena to Rudy Giuliani and other things. And then eventually, if they decide to impeach, which is basically the endorsement of an allegation, then there's a trial in the Senate. Now, you know, the semi-legitimate accusation made by Trump supporters is on the strength of the whistleblower complaint alone, or reports about the whistleblower complaint, Democrats went from 0 to 60 on the impeachment inquiry. And I mean, I think the argument still fails for a variety of reasons, but the most legitimate ones of them, the most responsible ones of them are saying, I don't really follow. You have something, you know, thin like this. We don't know the credibility of the whistleblower ourselves. We don't have other evidence yet. And you all of a sudden decided to prejudge and go down the road of impeachment. That is not great.
But that's also not the case. And so on its face, it makes a little bit of sense. I agree with you that they're making it because they think that that might appeal to people who initially would say, yeah, it's just a reporting of a whistleblower without credible facts behind it. Why should we have an impeachment inquiry based on that? That would be fair. But it's not just that. It is the president's phone call with the Ukrainian president, Zelensky. It is the president's admissions that he was on that call. It is subsequent reporting that the evidence of that call, the readout of that call, was moved from one computer to another that was more secretive. And so, which appears to me to be consciousness of guilt, like you're hiding something. So it really, it would be great. And by the way, many criminal defendants would want to argue the same thing. Well, just look at the first report that came through and say, well, that 911 call, you know, they said the smell, I can't keep this analogy, but I'll just go with it. Let's say you get a 911 call of wrongdoing at a location and it turns out to have been at another location and the police find wrongdoing. That doesn't mean that that crime can't be prosecuted just because, yeah, we're going a little far from where I mean to go.
But it happens all the time that the initial tip.
The tip here was right, but it wouldn't matter if it wasn't in some ways because you get to the underlying evidence so quickly and the underlying evidence is very clear.
Yeah. And by the way, the other logical point that I've seen been made and needs to be made every single day, every hour of every day is to the extent, Mr. Giuliani, Mr. Trump, you're saying you don't want us to proceed to make decisions about impeachment on secondhand information. Okay, understood. Then please don't stand in the way of our getting firsthand information. Make sure you provide these documents that Rudy Giuliani brags about collecting. Make sure you give us access to these witnesses who actually were on the phone call and have the ability to both incriminate you and also exculpate you. You can't on the one hand, it's just nonsense. Every day, it makes my head explode, more so than even in the past, to get on TV and beat the table every single minute and say, secondhand, secondhand, secondhand. And in the same breath, when asked about getting firsthand information, well, you can't have that, there's privilege, etc. It's nonsense, it's BS, and I think it should be called out every minute.
That's a great point. I would also say, just to be clear for people who are listening, because I think the hearsay is intended to confuse matters, this argument by the administration that there's hearsay in there, it should be very clear to everyone that the president's phone call is not hearsay. The statements made by the president are not hearsay. Any allegation that there's hearsay at the foundation of this conversation and at this inquiry is just patently wrong. And so, you know, I almost don't want to talk about it because I don't want to give it air, but I think it's important for us to address it. And remember also, this isn't a criminal court, right? Like, that's the other funny thing of like...
Hearsay doesn't matter. Like, you know, Lindsey Graham, erstwhile lawyer, I think...
Allegedly.
...says things and just confuses with the public. He makes proclamations. Like, he says, you can't get a parking ticket. I think he said this. You can't get a parking ticket on hearsay evidence in this country. I hope you can't impeach a president based on it.
Which turns out to be not true.
Well, one of the things that also happens to be true, and he knows it, is that you can obtain in this country a federal criminal indictment against a citizen of the United States of America based on hearsay in the grand jury, which is a set of allegations just like impeachment would be. So, you know, for those
now,
of you who are not
trial,
lawyers,
yeah. At the trial, you can't have hearsay.
Of course.
But the charging instrument can have hearsay and always does, frankly, in the federal government, almost always.
It's worth saying as a caution to the investigators, and the folks on the Intel Committee, the Oversight Committee, and the Judiciary Committee, I do think it's important to collect evidence that's direct, which I think they're doing, and to overcome obstacles to getting that information and to getting that testimony. So you can paint a picture that doesn't come solely from the whistleblower, from other folks who talk about the phone calls, and we're going to get to Australia and Italy in a second, and convince people, hopefully a little bit on a bipartisan basis, that something nefarious happened here. And I know that Nancy Pelosi and others want this to happen very, very, very quickly. There's always a tension between speed and thoroughness, and you have an added dimension here that you have in every criminal case, because justice not only needs to be done, it needs to be seen to be done. Here, especially when it's a political process, you want people to not think it's rushed. You want people to believe it's, you know, focused and thorough and not prejudged in a way that some people, I think, can get over their skis politically and make it seem so. So all the nonsense about the whistleblower is wrong, but note to the wise, they need to be a little bit careful about it. Last point on the whistleblower, what do you think? The degree to which the President of the United States is seeking the identity of the whistleblower and talking about both the whistleblower and the chair of the Intel Committee as having maybe spied and committed treason, how dangerous is that?
So let's separate the whistleblower from Chairman Schiff for a second and just focus on the whistleblower. It is beyond outrageous. I don't even know if I have words to describe how awful I think it is that the President of the United States has publicly targeted the whistleblower and said, we are trying to find the whistleblower's identity, has said it's like being a spy, and has made all kinds of derogatory statements about the whistleblower being politically motivated with no basis for any of those allegations. The entire purpose of the whistleblower statute is to allow people to come forward in secrecy to provide this information to the inspector general. And the president, it's not that he doesn't understand it, he doesn't care, because someone is opposing him. And what the president has done repeatedly is vilify people who disagree with him. And so anyone who disagrees with him is corrupt, is wrong, is politically motivated, and it is part of this whole deep state conspiracy that the president argues. And it is outrageous that the president has targeted the whistleblower. So I don't know how many ways I could possibly say this, but it is one of the things that I saw and really, you know, you and I have both seen a lot, and I think I'm not startled by a lot. This, to me, it crosses such a fundamental line of what democracy and the rule of law is about, which is that, you know, this is how the law is structured to put checks and balances into our government. And the president, again, is trying to eviscerate all of that.
It's going to be character assassination of the first order. The whistleblower statute is supposed to protect a true whistleblower who, by the way, in this case, didn't leak to the press, crossed every T, dotted every I, got the approval of the inspector general of the intelligence community, an appointee of Donald Trump. At a minimum, he should not have to worry that the leader of the free world, the commander in chief, goes on television and suggests maybe execution is the right consequence for his playing by the rules and doing the right thing as an exercise of conscience. It's extraordinary, and it's an abomination. Really.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's what dictators do. It's not what democratically elected presidents should be doing. Can we talk about Schiff for a second?
Yeah. So I have a lot of respect for Adam Schiff. And I do think, you know, the reporting has been that it looks like Nancy Pelosi likes the idea of Adam Schiff and the Intel Committee taking the lead. Maybe that makes sense on Ukraine because it's sort of an intelligence matter. This was all triggered by an ICIG letter sent to Adam Schiff. But I think that the thinking also is that for various reasons, given his abilities as a former prosecutor, it makes sense for him to be the point person on this, not the Judiciary Committee. So Adam Schiff makes a few errors. He decided to engage in some, you know, exaggeration for effect at the hearing with McGuire. And he prefaces the remarks by saying, you know, in not so many words, this is the essence of what the president communicates. So he's signaling that he's not quoting directly. And then he says, you know, mimicking the president, I hear what you want. I have a favor I want from you, though, and I'm going to say this only 7 times, so you better listen good. I want you to make up dirt on my political opponent. Understand lots of it. And it's clear to an intelligent person, I think, that he was trying to get to the core of what the president was intending to convey. And you might argue that in summation. You might say, here's what the words say, but you know what he meant. What he meant was this. And boy, the minority members of the committee and the president himself, they've gone to town on Adam Schiff. Did he make a mistake?
Yes, he made an enormous mistake. And so two points. First of all, the president tweets out not long after, he gave the president a little bit of the high ground on this in a way that he should not have, right? Because the readout speaks for itself, and he should have read the exact words. The president tweets out on September 30th, Rep. Adam Schiff illegally made up a fake capital, all caps, fake, and terrible statement, pretended it to be mine as the most important part of my call to the Ukrainian president, and read it aloud to Congress and the American people. It bore no relationship to what I said on the call. Arrest for treason, question mark. So
pause on that. Adam Schiff says a couple of things, mild exaggeration, that he prefaces with, this is in essence what the president was saying, arrest for treason?
Right. And the president and his team can lie without any repercussions or accountability, but Adam Schiff makes a misstatement. So the president attacked this quickly. And just to hone in on one thing you said, which is exactly what I wrote in my notes as I was reading this yesterday, it's a summation statement that Adam Schiff made. What Schiff could have done in a trial is basically read the actual letter as an evidence and then said to the jury, ladies and gentlemen, you know exactly what the president was saying. What the president was saying is, and then
exactly.
And then that sentence is fine because it's Schiff's version of, this is how I hear the president's words, not this is what the president said. And so my issue with this, Preet, is that, and I think you're a bigger Adam Schiff fan than I am. I think he's good, but I think he's hyperbolic. He often exaggerates. He often goes too far when you see him on the Sunday shows. And the truth is that the facts are dramatic enough. And this is a great example where, and look, I think you're right that he's good. I personally think he gave them something to hit him on. And when you're doing this kind of stuff, you never do that.
Here's the reality, right? The Washington Post can write story after story after story, perfectly reported, all confirmed by other outlets, confirmed by the government, the administration later, and you make one error that you correct within an hour, and Donald Trump weaponizes it. And so you just have to be really careful. So it's a cautionary tale going forward. Before we leave the whistleblower and this controversy, since we're talking about the press, the New York Times has given a lot of identifying information about the whistleblower. It's caused a lot of people to get upset. Some people are calling for the editor-in-chief, the New York Times, Dean Baquet, to step down. People are canceling their subscriptions. You know, I think it's an interesting question, right? What an outlet can report.
Do you think they should have reported it?
Yeah, you know, I err on the side of not doing that. I believe in the First Amendment, but given what's at stake here and given how much the president is saying about this person and how identifiable he may be or she may be, I think I'd err on the side of less.
I agree.
So they reported that he's a CIA officer who was assigned to the White House. It's a small universe of people. I mean, don't you think it's true that the Trump folks know who it is?
Yes. I also think that the reason that the New York Times gave, articulated for having released the information, was to help the public judge the credibility of the whistleblower complaint. Now, I reject that completely. I don't know if it's intentionally false or if it's just their justification to say the public deserves to see everything. I do not think the New York Times should have released that information. And their justification, frankly, doesn't have merit because I don't see any way in which it helps members of the American public. They already knew that the whistleblower was a member of the intelligence community. They eventually, at this point in time, see both the whistleblower complaint. They see the readout. And so it words fail me. I mean, that just feels to me like that's not going to help any American judge credibility in a way that warrants disclosing information. You know, any information that the Times would have given about the person's gender and employment does not assist in a meaningful way in the credibility determination. And so to me, and I understand that this may be a balancing test that the newspapers have to engage in under the First Amendment and their feeling about transparency, but this to me, it puts in direct harm someone, and the benefits are just, in my view, not there.
There are a lot of differences in this, you know, very famous example. But, you know, maybe the biggest, most famous whistleblower of all time with regard to presidential scandal was Deep Throat, whose identity was kept secret by the Washington Post for 40 years until he died. Didn't seem to affect the investigation or the impeachment inquiry, did it?
That's a great point. Yeah.
There's, you know, looking at the list of things to cover, and there's some, one thing we've forgotten to talk about so far, and it seems like a long time ago, but it's one of the biggest explosive revelations from the complaint by the whistleblower, is the fact that not only did this call take place between the president and the Ukrainian president, but that it was basically locked down in a special, secret, compartmented server, not for reasons of classification, according to the complainant, but because it was politically sensitive and would make the president look terrible, and that Maybe there are other calls like this. I have suggested, and others have also, we'd like to see what the calls sound like with members of the Saudi regime and with Vladimir Putin, which we now know, by the way, the president has fought really, really hard. He took away the translator's notes from his conversation with Putin in Helsinki. He says a lot of weird things to Putin in context that no other president ever has. Private conversations, given what we know now about Ukraine and what we know about Australia, which we still haven't gotten to, I think it stinks.
Yes, I agree. And it was the biggest thing. There were a lot of things about the whistleblower complaint that were important. The biggest thing to jump out at me was this aspect of cover-up. And what is critically important is that, as a rule, these readouts, they're sort of memorandums of the call, those go into a secure server. So it's important, and there's a great Washington Post op-ed by a former member of the National Security Staff and senior Pentagon official, a woman named Kelly Magsiman, who helped classify calls for two presidents. She writes that the White House abuse of the system is alarming, and she talks about the fact that the calls already go into a highly secret system. And what she writes is that material up to, quote, top secret is stored on a highly secure classified computer system used by the National Security Staff, not the code word server. And so all the calls are classified. They can be classified up to top secret, which is an incredibly high level of classification. Those calls go into this standard server. That is routinely done. And the fact that this call went into that server and then was removed and put into the code word server, and the code word meaning you need a special code word to be able to get into it. And what Kelly Magsiman says is that the code word status is reserved for the absolutely most sensitive subset of information within the top secret category. And she writes that moving it from one server to the other would be justified only if a president and foreign leader were discussing material so sensitive that intelligence officials with top secret clearance had to be read into access to it, an unlikely prospect even with our closest allies. Moving the memo to the code word server suggests Trump officials really did know the call was as bad as the president's critics say it is. And that's her writing, which is basically explaining that it is an extraordinary thing to move it from one server to the other. There's no basis to have done that here. And I think it's enormously important when you think about consciousness of guilt. One of the things we talk about in criminal cases all the time is the number of steps someone takes. You know, if someone drops a pen, was it intentional or accidental? It's really hard to know. If somebody removes something puts something in a server and then someone later removes it, puts it into another server, that's a lot of steps that are being taken to secret it from the eyes of a number of people. And so I think that's among the most problematic things that we've seen.
So that's all completely correct. The question will be, what is the drumbeat of other phone calls? Because the administration's conduct, Donald Trump's conduct, will likely not stand or fall based on a single phone call between him and the Ukrainian president. It's a political process. You want to see more. And there's a lot of pattern evidence emerging very quickly. And it's only been like three days since the whistleblower complaint was unsealed. So we hear about Australia. In the New York Times, in the first sentence of an article published just a few days ago, reads, quote, President Trump pushed the Australian Prime Minister during a recent telephone call to help Attorney General William P. Barr gather information for a Justice Department inquiry that Mr. Trump hopes will discredit the Mueller investigation, according to two American officials with knowledge of the call. That's significant, among other reasons, that people are being kind of chatty now. And other people maybe are emboldened in coming forward. Maybe there'll be more whistleblowers. I don't know. So a couple of questions arise from this. One is the fact that it turns out, according to the Justice Department, that Donald Trump made the call at William Barr's request. Now, I don't know if the Justice Department put that out because they thought it made the president look better. It makes, I think, everyone look worse. And then how does it compare to the Ukraine call?
Well, let's go back just for a second and remind listeners of what this investigation is that Barr's working on. Barr has tapped the Connecticut U.S. attorney, a guy named
John Durham,
to basically investigate the investigators, to ask the question of why the entire investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election began, and really to ask the question of, was the FBI justified in opening up an investigation into Russia and into the president of the United States for obstruction of justice, ultimately. And so they're really trying to litigate the start of everything. And to say it wasn't justified for there to be, the FBI wasn't justified to do this. Now, that's problematic on so many levels. First of all, Robert Mueller went on to find without question that the Russian government had hacked the Democratic National Committee and Clinton email servers, that the Russian government had engaged in a social media campaign, and that all of this was done on behalf of President, then candidate Donald Trump, in his favor and against Hillary Clinton. That is uncontroverted, that it through a long criminal investigation, there are hundreds of pages of the Mueller report. There are hundreds of pages of indictments against individuals who have been associated with the Russian government and Russian security services. So what Barr and the Connecticut U.S. attorney are trying to do is basically go back and find fault with that initial thing. There's no allegation that that was started for criminal purposes, right? That there was an intentional effort to discredit Donald Trump by opening the initial investigation into the Russians. So I find it very problematic. I also find it deeply disturbing because the president talks about this all the time. It is one of his political repeated political statements, is that the investigation itself was not legitimate.
Well, it's like what he's doing with the whistleblower. If anyone has a temerity to look at anything with respect to him, or is a reporter, a journalist who says something about him, even if it's at his beloved Fox, they're the devil, they're the enemy of the people, they should be brought up on treason charges. He doesn't mince words, and that's that.
And that's what he's doing. And by the way, everyone who's ever been convicted of a crime or arrested by the police or the FBI would like the investigators to be investigated. So we should just say he's not the first person who's been, you know, investigated to say, well, someone who's been, you know, particularly sort of found to have engaged in some wrongdoing, even though, you know, Mueller didn't make the ultimate call. The Mueller report does set out a number of instances that are deeply problematic.
Right.
And, you know, in our view, I think both of us provide evidence of obstruction of justice.
Right.
So he's trying to undercut that. One of the things that's weird about this, though, before we even come back to this call, is that both Barr and the president have spent so much time saying that the Mueller report exonerated the president.
Yeah. Why do you need to undermine?
Right. Why do you need to, like, spend all this time and effort?
But that's the other thing here to understand. It's good that you sort of set the background. It is not an ordinary investigation. It's not a standard sort of mafia investigation or money laundering investigation of the kind that has no bearing on politics. This investigation, with respect to which Donald Trump was trying to get cooperation from the Australians, is one that has deep personal political significance to the president of the United States in a way that's different from, but not that different from, his deep personal interest in having Joe Biden investigated by the Ukrainian government, right? So it's not a garden variety case. They're doing the same thing here that they've done with respect to the Ukraine call, which both distinguishes it but also shows the similarity. They say in the Ukraine call, the president cares about corruption. Broad concept, nothing wrong with that. President Obama, President Bush, President Reagan calls up another country with whom we have treaty obligations or trade and says, or with China, for example. This happens all the time with China. China has bad people in the country and some people at the government level who engage in the theft of intellectual property. And if you care about that, you say, you need to stop doing that. If, on the other hand, you, in the process of saying the general statement, you mentioned, and also Joe Biden and Joe Biden's son. Why are you mentioning Joe Biden? No reason. And just about corruption. And the same thing here. It's a particular investigation that the president is involved in and cares about because it will inure to his benefit. He wants to discredit something, and we've talked about that. So that then goes to the question, was it inappropriate for President Trump to be calling the Australian prime minister? And if you believe the spin, it can seem on its face, well, it is different from Ukraine because it's not going after a political rival that you name like Joe Biden, but it is similar in the sense that you're once again blurring the line between politics and law enforcement, between the Justice Department and the president, and you have to know that it's going to look a little bit bad. And so I'm actually dumbfounded that Bill Barr told the president to make this call, apparently maybe also made such a call to the Italian leader.
And Great Britain.
Like, do these people learn nothing?
So I agree with you completely. I actually think that Australia and these other countries and Ukraine are far more similar than a lot of people in the media and even our colleagues who are former prosecutors are saying. And I do think it is to the president's political benefit. I think it is all about his personal politics and him wanting to refute every aspect of the Mueller report. And I very much think that it is not a legitimate investigation, that the questions being asked are not. While it's always fair to ask questions about the investigators, it feels to me like this is, there's been no evidence put forward as a predicate of wrongdoing that's sufficient to justify this investigation. But to your point, and I think it's worth just zeroing in on the Barr Trump piece here. First of all, I'm not so sure I believe that Barr asked the president to call, right?
Really?
Yes.
Really? That's very interesting. You think he's trying to save face for the president?
I don't know what's going on between. It's like impossible to judge, but it feels very strange to me. And you and I have talked about this before. But when you are the Attorney General of the United States, people take your call.
They do.
They do.
They even would take my call.
Yes. As a U.S. attorney. Exactly.
Yes.
So the idea that Bill Barr needed the president's political influence, I find that really difficult to believe. The second piece is that, you know, I was a state AG. I was appointed politically by the governor. I was an independent officer. When I did any type of investigations, do you know how much I talked to the governor about him?
How much?
Zero.
Oh.
Zero. I would never. The idea that it's a complete blurring of the lines between the law enforcement function and the political function.
I'll tell you what else happens, what I find interesting. Put the president aside for a moment. The fact that the attorney general himself appears to be in Italy to try to get cooperation on this investigation of the investigators, and he's involving himself in these other things. Yeah, the attorney general can do things like that. But you make a decision about whether you delegate those things to career folks or not. You know, in my time in office, and maybe other people would be different, and it's not necessarily illegitimate. But also, if you hire well and you trust the people who are under you, you let them do the work. There were many high-profile interviews of prominent politicians in New York. You know, the four most powerful people in New York were all investigated by my office. Two of them were charged. Several of them were interviewed. I would have loved to be the person going into the conference room and personally as the United States attorney, as might happen on billions, and interview the individual, whether it's the Speaker of the Assembly or somebody else. I didn't. And I did it in part because I didn't want to take, you know, sort of the, you know, the capstone part of the investigation away from a career prosecutor. But I also thought that in retrospect, to the extent someone could claim, and this wouldn't be true, but someone could claim that I was acting politically or I had some kind of agenda, you took that argument away from them and you let the career people, which, by the way, you think is why they put John Durham in charge of the investigation. Right. That's the whole point, to have someone who was at arm's length from the White House, who's at arm's length from the Attorney General even, who has a longstanding reputation for doing sensitive political investigations and doing them well and earning the respect of his colleagues and the public. You have John Durham. Why the hell is the president calling Australia?
Yeah, those are great points. The other piece, to your point, and it's worth addressing this because I think to the extent our former colleagues are a little bit more forgiving of this, part of it is that there does exist a Department of Justice process, the MLAT process. We have mutual lateral assistance treaties with many other countries where a line prosecutor puts in a request and says, we want to interview this person, whether it's in Italy. I did a lot of work through that process in Mexico. There's an international office at the Department of Justice, and they do a lot of this. And they work with their counterparts in other countries, and they figure out, can we get access to people in other countries, and can we get them interviewed? Now, that process is not what's happening here. And so it's really important to note that, yes, that's a legitimate process, but both the Attorney General of the United States, William Barr, and the U.S. Attorney for Connecticut are subverting that process. And the question is, why? And that makes it look political. To your point, it makes it look biased. To your point, it's like it's impossible that it needs to get to this level unless there's something else going on. And so I think we should be really suspicious about those conversations and those calls. I think, frankly, the president should release all of these calls that we're talking about at this point.
He pledged transparency. I don't know what you think about this argument, but the fact that they so quickly released the readout of the call and the whistleblower's complaint and saying we want to be transparent and it was a perfect call, it makes it a little bit harder to throw up a roadblock later. Not legally harder, but I think politically a little bit harder. So you don't believe it, even though the Department of Justice specifically put out a statement saying that the president's call was made at the behest of William Barr?
So it makes me sad to say that I would question the statement made by the United States Department of Justice, but the short answer is yes, I am skeptical. That doesn't mean it's not accurate, but it doesn't make sense to me that the Attorney General for the United States of America has to have the president call to get anything done on it doesn't make sense to me that the attorney general has to ask the president of the United States to call as part of this.
All right, so here we are. We're past an hour and we haven't gotten everything because so much is happening. Just further to what we've been saying with Australia and Italy and the UK, I think we're going to see a lot of shoes drop. We'll be back next week to talk about those things. But we haven't gotten a chance to talk about the reporting that the Trump administration continues to look at associates of Hillary Clinton with respect to how they used emails, retroactively classified information suggesting to a number of people who worked in the Obama State Department that they may have engaged in misconduct because of the emails, even though, as far as I can tell, the statute of limitations for any criminal case have long elapsed. And it looks like lots of other things that go on here as purely vindictive and an obsession with Hillary Clinton and taking vengeance upon political adversaries.
Yes, I agree. And it's also very clear that the emails were classified after they were sent. And so they may be investigating why they weren't classified up front, but it is deeply, deeply troubling. And it does look like political retribution.
Because the reason these things all look like political retribution, it's not like, you know, two former prosecutors sitting here, you know, pontificating. It's because the president, as we're on a daily basis, talks about retaliation, you know, in the instant case of the whistleblower, says that person should maybe be brought up on treason charges. So it's not outlandish to think these other things that are happening at the behest of the president who is bent on retaliation.
And I would like to know why it appears that there had been some movement. There are about 130 employees of the State Department. It's a lot of people. It looks like there have been some questions asked of those folks. And then it stalled and was and sort of brought back to life in August. And I would like to know who brought that back to life and what conversations triggered that.
We should get that call too. But it's amazing to me that we've gone this long and we haven't talked about something that I think is a hugely significant thing, but gets lost in the mess of other hugely significant things. And that is, if you believe the reporting of the New York Times, the embattled head of the NRA, Wayne LaPierre, met with the President of the United States to talk about whether the NRA could help with the president's anti-impeachment effort if the president laid off these gun regulations that have been talked about. The first sentence of the article says, President Trump met in the White House on Friday with Wayne LaPierre, the chief executive of the National Rifle Association, and discussed prospective gun legislation and whether the NRA could provide support for the president as he faces impeachment and a more difficult reelection campaign, according to two people familiar with the meeting. What's up with that?
I was reading all the articles about this, I kept thinking quid pro quo.
Oh.
You know, there's been a lot of conversation about sort of I'll do this in exchange for that. It certainly looks deeply problematic. It's also just a question of LaPierre is embattled for many reasons, and there have been a number, just a sort of mass number of resignations from the NRA board. It's very strange to me that the president would take the meeting at this time, and it's a very political meeting, is I guess what I would say. And I think you're right to say that it appears that the president is very focused on getting support and assistance on the impeachment questions. We need to know more, and I would like there to be a fuller account of this conversation. But it certainly, if it turned out to be true that the president was trading support or lack of support for gun measures for assistance with the impeachment fight, that would be deeply troubling and problematic.
Do you think we have enough reporters, enough journalists to be looking at all this?
God, I don't know.
So there were so many shoes that dropped. We wanted to get through all these issues. I think it's important for us to, I think, explore a little bit more deeply how the impeachment inquiry should unfold, how it likely will unfold, how broad it should be, how narrow it should be, which witnesses should be called, how quickly they should do it. Next week, we'll try to do that in a little bit more depth.
And thanks for everyone for sending your questions in. It helps us figure out what topics to address and how to think about the many pieces of news that are coming across our desk.
Keep sending us your questions to insider@cafe.com.
And we'll do our best to answer them. Bye, Preet.
Bye, Ann.
Later, Skater.
This is the Cafe Insider Podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Ann Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Aaron Dalton. And the Cafe team is Carla Pierini, Julia Doyle, Calvin Lord, David Kurlander, and Jeff Eisenman. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.
The nature of whistleblowing is that you're blowing on the whistle. Sorry, let's redo that.
I say keep that.
The nature.
I think the term used to be whistle on blower. And then they change it to whistleblower.
The nature of whistleblowing.